Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Mark Childress, whose latest novel is Georgia Bottoms. Earlier novels include One Mississippi, Crazy in Alabama, Gone for Good, the seven novels in all, plus three books written in the 1990s for children. Mark Childress is also the screenplay writer for the film of Crazy in Alabama, and he was born in Monroeville, Alabama, same place as Harper Lee and Truman Capote, and for a time lived in San Francisco, and Mark and I were friends back in those days, which I guess was the 1980s, I think. You just come out with your first novel, and you were writing V for Victor?
That's right. Yeah, I moved here in 1987, just in time for the plague. Those were some days.
Some days. But this book is not about San Francisco. What it's about is a character named Georgia Bottoms, living in a small town in Alabama and her adventures. And it's a comic novel that is both character-based and, more importantly, I think it's also very plot-heavy in that there's a lot of plot to it, which is a little bit different than some of your other work, which meant that you must have tackled the book a little bit differently than your other work.
I did. I'm following up One Mississippi, which was a big and dark book. And it took me 8 years, and I was writing about high school, which I hated. So I actually added, 8 years to my high school experience. And after 12 years of high school, I was ready to do something a little more fun. And also, this was in the immediate wake of 9/11, and I was just thinking, what kind of book do I want to read? A funny book. I think that's what we need, a little comedy.
This book began then, but you were still working on One Mississippi at the time?
Right. Actually, this book was born on 9/11, even though it's in no way a 9/11 story. I was living in downtown Manhattan, and late on that day, as the smoke was settling, I got a call from an old friend in Alabama, and he was telling me that his grandmother was the mayor of a little town in Alabama, and she had sent the town's only policeman over to guard the water tower from Al-Qaeda. And I laughed. But then I stopped laughing, and I thought, that's the most noble thing I've ever heard. You know, the rest of us are running around like chickens with our heads cut off. We don't know what to do. She knew what to do. She knew that she was going to protect her little part of the world from the big bad outside. And I thought, I want to write a book that's a little scene in. And so, as you know, it's a very minor scene and kind of goes by really quickly. But in this case, it's sort of a comedy born out of a tragedy.
Well, where were you exactly when the planes hit?
9th Street and 3rd Avenue. I was at my desk. I was typing an email about the Michael Jackson concert I'd been to the night before. And the plane flew over my desk, and I said, that plane's crashing.
Really?
And I counted to five, and boom. I turned around and pressed my remote on my TV, and the live traffic copter had swung its camera around and was already showing the smoke pouring out of the building. So I immediately knew what had happened, because that week they had just convicted the bomber from the 93 bombing, right? And so everybody in New York was very conscious of Al-Qaeda at that moment. So for me, there was no question. Immediately it was terrorism. You know?
And did you wind up staying in your apartment during the day, just watching the tube?
For the most part, but I did a lot of chasing around after friends' children who were all AWOL because nobody could get phone calls in and out. I had several friends who had kids in college there. So I'd track them down and say, don't go down there. Go call your mother. That was sort of the purpose I served that day. I tried to give blood, but they didn't need the blood, as it turned out.
And you were working on One Mississippi at the time?
I was.
And how long did it take you before you were able to get back to work?
I spent about a year watching CNN. I couldn't even go to sleep without the news on. You know, when you lived in Manhattan during that, there was a lot of threats that turned out not to be true, but the whole climate was kind of freaky at that time.
Did that change at all the book? I mean, did One Mississippi get darker, you think, because of your mood? I mean, how does a writer's mood influence a book, even though it's a coming-of-age novel from a different era?
It did. I knew that the book was going to have a violent ending, but I didn't know what ending it would have. And there was something about that dark day when I finally went back to it, I knew what I was going to do. And I knew it would be kind of an explosion of violence. I guess I was trying to get that out of my system.
I remember people were talking about that day as the end of irony, which I guess is a kind of ironic thing to say now.
Yeah, looking back. Well, I said a lot of ironic things. I'm glad I didn't say them on the air or something, you know. But I remember saying that if Al-Qaeda had had a wax-seeking missile, we'd all be dead from all the candle memorials all over Manhattan. Wherever you stepped, there was wax, you know. It was a strange time to be a New Yorker. But I also remember the first time I heard two taxis honking at each other in anger about 3 weeks after the attack. And it was like, oh, thank God, we're going back to normal now.
Moving on to the writing of this book. So you finished One Mississippi in 2005, I would guess. Mm-hmm. About a year before publication. Did you immediately go back to that idea?
I just knew that I wanted to write something funny because I had been struggling with that dark story for a long time, you know, and I'd gotten that out of my system. And it just felt like it was so light for me to do that. It was just so freeing. You know, I had a conversation with my agent, and I was working on all these big tortured novel ideas, and he said, "Don't you want to write something funny?" I said, "Okay, I think maybe I do. You're right."
At that point, you had one scene. So take us through how you go from one scene of a mayor guarding some towers to a very original female character and her adventures, and particularly also creating a very tight plot.
Well, I knew that the mayor was only a minor character, and I knew that I didn't want the book to be a 9/11 book, so that scene was just going to be something that happened in passing. But I got to thinking about a very proper Southern Baptist woman sitting in the Baptist church, and she's thinking about the fact that she doesn't believe in anything that's going on in the church. So I immediately wanted a subversive character, and I created this little town called Six Points, which I say is a town that's so small there's not even cell phone service or a Walmart. Yeah, I think that's a fable. I'm not sure there's anywhere there isn't cell phone service anymore, but I wanted to put someone who was in a sort of lost in time little town like that and then put her in opposition to that. So I have her sitting in church and she's thinking about the new dress she wants to buy and her hair and her fingernails and why she doesn't believe in Jesus, and then she looks up and she notices the hickey on the neck of the preacher and she starts thinking about the fact that she's the person who put it there the night before.
And that was the beginning. At that point, you had no plot. You had just had a character sitting in church.
I didn't know what she was going to look up and see, but then she saw his hickey, and I went, oh, my God, she gave it to him.
Some events occur early on in the novel that, of course, come back to haunt her later, which is why I say it's plot-driven. At that point, did that just evolve naturally? So it's kind of like you knew you were putting a gun in a handbag and that later on that gun would be pulled out?
You know, seven novels in, I find that the more complicated a situation, a pickle you put your character in, the more fun it is going to be to watch that pickle become unraveled. So I figured someone who's sitting in church and hears her secret lover about to confess to the entire town that he's been doing it with her, I thought, well, that's a pretty fraught moment, you know. And from that, some great drama can spring, or maybe some comedy, or a combination of the two.
You always knew it would be a comedy. I mean, you've written comic novels before, Crazy in Alabama. How easy or hard is writing comedy?
Well, to me, all my books are funny. It's just that some people laugh at some of them, and then they don't laugh at the others. To me, they're all comedies. But it has to do with where the book is taking you. Somehow in a comedy, at the end, there's usually, if you think about it, back to the Middle Ages, there's usually some sort of a celebration, or there's some sort of a moment where there's a marriage, or where things go positively into the future, whereas a tragedy is the opposite of that. And so you're sort of buoyant because you know that you're going to a sort of a light destination, that there's a happy ending, and you're not just going to try to turn your dark story into something happy.
Well, without giving away the very ending of the book, when I closed the book, I was laughing. Had you always known that the book would end on a joke?
I knew that that's exactly where it was going to end, and that she would be headed to a destination that's perhaps not as peaceful as she thinks it's going to be. But actually, in my original concept for the book, her story goes on and on and on into the further adventures of where she's going. But by the time I got there, I was already 450 pages in the manuscript, and I said, I think that's a novel right there.
So. Well, do you ever intend to take her further in the adventures?
You know, I think I might. A lot of people are responding well to the character, and I really had fun spending time with her. I've never written a sequel before. And on the one hand, it feels kind of lazy. It's like you're just starting with your characters that you already know. But I'm just not quite done with her. I really had fun spending time with her, and she surprised me at points.
Well, when you say she surprised you, what exactly do you mean?
Honest to God, I think if you're doing your work correctly and you're at a certain point in the book, it's not that the characters are real people that push you around and tell you what to do, But they do tend to take on a life of their own, and they do sometimes tend to do things that you didn't imagine. And that's when you know that the thing is working, because they have become, in your mind at least, real people.
In that sense, is it you're busy typing, let's say, and suddenly a sentence comes out and you're going, you scratch your head and go, where the hell did that come from?
Yeah, what does that mean? A hickey on his neck. Who put that hickey on his neck? And then I go, oh my God, she did, you know? So yeah, it is that moment of revelation. I figure if I'm surprised, then the reader will be too.
It allows you also to play with satire in terms of racism, sexism. But that is never conscious, or is it? I mean, her mother's a racist. How conscious was that? Or did that just, again, flow out of, oh, she's a racist?
Well, no, it's more like I wanted our character, Georgia, to be kind of a free-thinking, modern, liberal person. And that one of the better ways to illustrate that would be to put her next to somebody who's a dinosaur and let them come into conflict. I mean, all good fiction is born out of conflict. You know, it's not happy people sitting around talking about things they agree about. It's two kinds of lives in opposition. So, you know, her mother thinks everything bad in the world is due to Rosa Parks. I mean, if only Rosa Parks had not sat down on that bus, she thinks the world would be a much better place. And of course, George is in complete opposition to her mother throughout on this. To me, that's part of where the comedy is. I don't think we're in a post-racial society, but I love the fact that I can make comedy out of racists, because it's kind of, to me, not to put myself on the level of Chaplin, but when he made a joke out of Hitler in The Great Dictator, in a way, that was a triumph against Hitler before we ever even fired a shot against him. Once you reduce people like that to a joke, you're on your way to defeating the power that they have. So I enjoyed that part.
Mark Childress, when you've got a character, and this is written in the close third person, which means it's third person, but we're always looking out through George's eyes. In that sense, she's kind of an unreliable narrator. She doesn't see what we see. And again, how conscious is the idea of making sure that we see things that she can't?
Well, in this case, it's kind of a fraught thing, because you want people to like the narrator. But on the other hand, she's doing some incredibly unlikable things. I mean, in terms of, she has all these secret lovers. We won't give away all the details of the plot, but she's got about 10 secret lives going at one time. And part of what I wanted to do was, you know, unpeel that onion, reveal her secrets one at a time. And that, to me, would put her in the starkest opposition to the place where she was. And out of that will come some comedy. I didn't know what the comedy would be. But I knew that if she was on a collision course with the small-town society, then Georgia would become a larger-than-life figure.
Where did the name come from, Georgia Bottoms?
I was just playing around with names, and I love Georgia as a female name. And, you know, I honestly have no idea where that floated up from. But as soon as I realized she was Georgia Bottoms, then I realized that the reason she's named that is because her grandmother changed the name from Butts because she thought Bottom sounded more genteel. So I must say I like that joke. And I went with it. But a lady came to my signing the other day. She said, "My grandmother's Georgia Bottoms. I'm buying this book for you." I said, "You might want to read it first before you give it to your grandma. She might not want to be identified with this character."
You made it a point at the beginning of the interview to say this is a place that doesn't have cell phones, which kind of moves it into a kind of fantasy South. Do you think having the latest technology really hinders storytelling?
You know, not so much. I really don't. I was at a Southern Writers Conference the other day, and the topic of discussion was, you know, is the South any different than anywhere else? And I pointed out that in Wisconsin, they're not sitting around having conferences about Wisconsin writing. We're so self-conscious of being Southern that we have become, in some ways, a caricature of ourselves. Because now we have conferences. There are entire, you know, institutes devoted to modern Southern fiction writing. And when Fanny Flagg and I were publishing our first books, we were about it as far as who was coming out of Alabama. Now they have conferences of them. There's so many Alabama writers, you know. It's kind of amazing to watch.
Mark Childress, you were born in Monroeville, and I mean, we talked about this years ago. You did have one letter from Harper Lee, and we talked about that. Do you think that the connection of Harper Lee and Truman Capote set you off on writing, or was it just happenstance?
No, absolutely. I think if you come from Reggie Jackson's hometown, you might want to be a slugger. I can tell you, when I first encountered that book, I was 10 years old. We didn't live there anymore, but we went back to visit my parents' best friends who lived there, Miss Wandy Biggs. And she sat me down on the front porch and said, "Here, you need to read this book," and gave me her first edition signed copy. And so for the next week, I sat on that porch and read the book. Well, she lived next door to Harper Lee. So she would come out and say, "Now, you see that stump over there? That's the tree where Boo Radley hid the presents. They cut it down a few years ago. And see this little path back here? That's where Jim broke his elbow coming back from the Halloween pageant." And for me, reading this magic book about this dumpy little town that I saw around me, I think that was the moment it became clear there was a person who created that, who made magic out of this town that I was seeing. And I think it must have been in that moment that it was born in my mind that, hey, there's a person who does that. Maybe that's something you could do.
When did you encounter Capote's writing?
It was shortly after, when I was in high school, I became a huge Capote head, and I read every single thing that he'd written. I thought I was him. You know, I chased around after him for many years.
Did you ever meet him?
I did. I tracked him down late in his life. I was trying to do an interview with him, and I got his home number at UN Plaza. I called him. He dropped the phone on the floor, and it was before answering machines, and I could hear the sink running and the toilet flushing, and about 10 minutes goes by. He picked it up and said, "Hello." I'm like, "Mr. Capote, this is Mark Childress." Did my little thing, and he said, "Darling, I only have one hair left on my head. I was in the middle of combing it." And I said, "Ah, this must be the Mr. Capote." So we arranged to meet. He was going to give me an interview, but when I finally met him, he was not in a condition to answer questions. So it was pretty late in his life. I was sad. I talked to him, but I couldn't get any quotes I could use.
Creating a novel that sits in time yet sits outside of time, that's what V for Victor is as well. What do you think it is about finding a space in history, but making it on some level contemporary to the time you're writing it? I mean, this is a little bit closer than, say, a book about set in World War II, but there's a certain similarity there. Do you pay attention to that at all, you think?
Well, I like that feeling when you read a book and you climb into another world. You just go somewhere different than where you are now. It's either in time, space, or just the culture is so different. I definitely wanted a town that was 5 steps out of the mainstream of the modern world, because I wanted my character to be like a modern woman struggling to live in that old-fashioned society. And so, I mean, these are all things I can think now that I've finished the book and read it. I don't sit down and, you know, parse out these themes and say, oh, that's what I'll write about. But looking at it, I can see I was writing about a person who's just sort of stuck in the past. You know, she's trying to be modern. She thinks she has all the right opinions. She thinks she's on the right side of every issue, race, you know, homosexuality, anything that rears its head as the modern world. But in fact, she's got a lot to learn. And the book is really her journey towards awareness. She thinks she's completely aware of everything in the beginning, but at the end, I think she's aware of how little she really knows.
Despite it taking place over, you know, 9/11 occurs during it, there's also a lack of any politics. I mean, is that because in places like Monroeville, outside of giving opinions based on nothing, there really isn't politics?
Well, there's a little politics.
There's
in
a
here,
little.
Right?
I mean, there's the business involving incorporating the black part of the
neighborhood. Well, and the brother gets obsessed with the guy who's running for governor, remember?
Oh, that's right. Yeah,
the judge who wants to install the Ten Commandments in the Supreme Court. So he forms a committee to promote the 11th commandment.
Now, did that happen when you suddenly read about this guy?
I remember, yeah, years ago reading about that guy and being convinced he was trying to, you know, to George Wallace his way into the governorship. And it's interesting because since this book's been released, he's announced that he's exploring the possibility of running for president. So thank you, world. I have brought you Judge Roy Moore. You need to go vote against him. But to me, the politics here is local, you
right.
know, as the famous saying, all politics is local. And it's very much she thinks that she's not involved in anything political. But it turns out she gets opposed to the entire town. You know, both for her racial politics, her sexual politics, those of her friends, and the rather subversive thing that she's doing to make a living.
And there's all kinds of things going on behind closed doors. In some respects, that's kind of the old days. Now everybody's supposed to show everything.
if I had the internet in this little town, see, I don't think the gossip would be as rich. And that's what happened when the internet came. You know, the gossip all went indoors before it was passed along on the street. You know, I lived in Costa Rica in the year 2000 when they got cable television. This was a town that had no television. And in 1 week, it went from being a place where people hung out on the street at night to a place where there was blue light flashing out of every window and no one walked the streets anymore. So I got to watch what happened in 1 week when the modern world came to a little town.
Did that change your feelings about living in a place like Costa Rica?
Well, it changed my feelings about living in a little town. We, up until that moment, had been a town completely out of time. You know, and living in a very old-fashioned way. We had electric light, but that's about it. And the telephones didn't work half the time. So, you know, if they got Lay's potato chips at the supermarket, there'd be like flag bearers and smoke signals going up. Hurry down, there's Lay's potato chips. They'll be gone by this afternoon. And it was actually that little Costa Rican town, I think, that inspired this Alabama town that I'm writing about.
Even more than where you grew up.
Yeah, because, well, that was the first place I ever lived that was a really small town where I lived as an adult. And there were about 200 expats in this town. So we constituted a town within the town. And if somebody was cheating, man, that word was all over town within 2 hours. That car was seen at that other person's house. And there's a line in this book that sort of expresses what I was trying to get at, which is that a small town seems sweet from the outside. But not when you grow up there, not when everybody's got the dirt on you. And there's an element of that in small towns, you know, that it's kind of like it's a very close society. If you violate the rules, then you're going to have to leave.
And Mark Childress, shortly thereafter, you did leave and you went back to New York. What was the culture clash like for you then?
Oh, that was a big culture clash, but I really wanted one. You know, I had been 4 hours from a movie theater. I really wanted some movies. I wanted, you know, Rush Hour at Grand Central Station. I lived in the jungle for 8 years, so I was really ready for a little human jungle.
Did you feel when you walked back in that you had missed something, or were luckily the book tours and the visits and the conferences?
I missed all the 90s. I missed all the cultural references, all the TV shows. Everybody talks about all the shows they watched, and I didn't see those. You know, but I caught up really quickly. You know, I hadn't had TV for 8 years. Suddenly I had like 4 screens in a one-room apartment. I couldn't get enough. I'm like LBJ with the multiple images going all the time.
When did you move down to Key West?
I bought a house there in 2008 and then decided just last summer that I'd live there full time. So I sold my New York place and moved down there.
Is it easy to write there then?
It's really easy. I'm far from the first writer to discover that it's a very amenable place to work. And I do kind of feel like I'm traveling in the footsteps of Tennessee Williams. I've lived in New Orleans and San Francisco and Key West and New York and Greenwich Village just like he did. He had good taste in domiciles, you know.
Mark Childress, I understand you're working on a film project now?
Yeah, I've always got my hand in something down there. I tend to believe the Hemingway dictum about the movies, which is, you know, as a novelist, you should meet them at a neutral state line. You throw them the book, and they throw you the money, and you turn around and run like hell for home. But I go down there, and I do it just to make money. The money's really good. To even go in and do a little doctoring job is sometimes more than I'll make on a novel.
What doctoring jobs have you done?
Well, I can't contractually comment on them, because if my name's not on the script, then I don't have a right to claim that I had anything to do with the writing of it.
Have you seen in the past year, let's say, your words on a big screen?
Yes, I have. You know, one scene in a movie. I was hired to fix one scene. And they had a problem with a scene at the ending, and I fixed the scene, and I was paid for that.
What is the screenplay Billy?
I wrote a movie about Billy Carter that was commissioned by Columbia Pictures, and so I went to Georgia, and I met with Billy's wife and his family and spent an hour or two with the ex-president of the United States. And I asked Jimmy, I said, so I say the words Billy Carter to you. What's the word you think? He said, hot-headed. And this was 10 years after Billy died. And I said, wow, there's still some resentment working there. And as it turned out, he completely blames Billy for the fact that he was not reelected. He said, if Billy hadn't gone to Libya and gotten messed up, it wouldn't have given Teddy Kennedy an excuse to come in and mess me up in the Democratic primaries. And so he was still bitter after all these years. And I thought, that's very instructive for my film.
Particularly since his loss had everything to do with Iran.
But not if you're Jimmy Carter. There's a more complicated story. It has to do with his vulnerability from his left which Billy provoked, you know. And so there's something to be said for that. But I think Jimmy very much resented the attention that Billy got and the buffoon character that he played on television, because Jimmy had spent his whole life trying not to be that guy.
And what happened to the screenplay? Just
it went into turnaround hell. Yeah. Now, yeah, various people said they loved it and it never got made.
Mark Childress, Crazy in Alabama, you did write the screenplay. How much of your screenplay wound up on screen? Did they stick close to it?
Every word of it, yeah.
Really?
I was lucky because I had a European director, Antonio Banderas. And in the world of European film, the writer's involved. So Antonio didn't know I was supposed to be fired immediately. So he let me be there for all of the pre-production, all the production, all of the post even. Yeah, I got to sit in the editing room with him. So whatever flaws are in that movie, and there's plenty of them, you know, they're mine. And the thing that I'm so proud of with that movie is it's very close to the book. And that's pretty rare in a Hollywood adaptation. And that took some fighting along the way.
And Georgia Bottoms, has there been any interest in it yet?
There's a little rumbling going around, especially when People magazine reviewed it. Apparently that's all they read in L.A. So once People said it was good, then the phone started ringing over at the agency. But it's pretty early days. But I have a feeling this one may be a movie. It feels like it to me now when I look back at it.
Well, it also feels like it would be a fairly easy adaptation for you to do.
Yeah, I'd love to write it. I think it'd be fun. But it's difficult because the trick is, if you think about it, all of Georgia's personality takes place inside her head. And she confides in no one throughout the book. Well, you can't do that in a movie. So immediately there's a problem. Who does she talk to? She has to tell her secrets to someone or we don't know them. So once again, I'm running into the thing of the media are two different media, a book and a film. And if you start trying to think about a movie while you're writing a novel, it just doesn't work. It's a completely different set of parameters you're trying to engage.
And what about a play? Have you ever thought about working on a play?
I would love to. I really have. And part of the reason I lived in New York was I went to tons of theater, and I was trying to find my way into that. And I haven't found the way. I met some great people in theater, so I have connections if I can, you know, come up with something to do. But I'd love to write a musical. I'm just wild for Broadway musicals. I just think they're a great art form. I'd love to do it.
Well, the problem is these days getting something produced that doesn't have a brand name attached to it is very, very difficult.
It's really tough, you know, and I've had friends who've been in that business their whole lives and can't get it done, so who am I to think I could? But, you know, you could start small in a regional theater and make it better. You know, it's nothing I've ever done, but I'm excited about trying it sometime.
How about short stories? Do you write short stories at all?
I did in college, and that was the last time ever. I don't really like to read them. I accept the classics that I read for college, but I don't feel satisfied. It's 15 pages. I want more. I guess I'm a maximalist, you know. So my short stories are 200 pages long. I tend
to read them one sitting.
As your listeners know, I tend to go on.
Well, Mark Childress, have you started working on another novel?
Yeah, I've already started. And so I'm pretty comfortable. I never talk about them when I'm working because it's like bad juju. If I tell you what the story is, then somehow the juice goes out of it for me. I don't have to tell it on the page.
Is it a comic novel?
I think this one's going to have a few darker tones mixed in. But all my books have some blend of comedy and tragedy. That one of my favorite writers is John Irving, and he does that so beautifully. It's something I've always aimed for, that sort of laughing through the tears effect.
And your children's stories, you wrote three of them. The first was Joshua and Big Tooth.
A boy and his gator.
Do you plan ever to work on those on any more?
I would love to. The problem is the children's book business is in a desperate situation. And, you know, they're not looking for anybody but the established writers who've done them and have a following. It's a really hard place to crack now. And when I was doing it in the 90s, it was a little more generous. There was more money running around.
Well, when you were down in Costa Rica, in terms of getting books to read, was that difficult? And now, I guess if you have a Kindle, it doesn't matter.
Well, I'm still a traditionalist. I got to have a book that you can go to sleep on and drool on and spill your ice cream on and throw the book across the room in a rage. If you do that in the Kindle, it breaks. I always came up to the States with an empty suitcase and filled it up with books and carried it down there. And everybody down there read because we didn't have TV, so we all traded books too.
Do you ever go into the Deep South these days?
I go all the time, yeah. I got lots of friends that live there still and a little bit of family still.
And what do they think of the politics, the Tea Party politics, the extreme right wing that seems to have taken a hold of parts of this country?
Well, in Alabama, we're used to having idiot politicians. I mean, you know, as long as I've been alive, there was George Wallace. What happens now in Alabama, to the rest of the world, I guess it still seems revanchist and recidivist. But the fact that Birmingham's had a black mayor now for 35 years is astounding to those of us who grew up under segregation. I mean, when I was 5 years old, if I walked down a sidewalk in Greenville, Alabama, a black man would have to step off the sidewalk to show respect for me as a five-year-old. And that day is gone. And thank God, you know, the South has changed a lot. And it's been exciting to watch that happen now. You know, there's still a lot of right-wingers and there's still a lot of racists. And the thing that's the most disappointing to me is to see evidence of racism in the new generation, because I thought we were just going to Darwin our way out of that. You know, that eventually, growing up in a post-Martin Luther King world, the new generations would come to understand that there is no difference. We're all just human beings. But you see young people who are voting hard right, you know, because that's what mom and daddy did. And that's disappointing to me. I guess that's one of my motivations for writing, is I really kind of hope to wake those kids up a little bit. And let's not forget our history. It's too damn recent for us to be forgetting.
And how about gay versus straight?
It's some better. You know, when I was growing up, when I was in Jackson, Mississippi, I've read a book called Mississippi Sissy by Kevin Sessoms. Wonderful book, by the way. But he explores this entire gay subculture that existed in Jackson, Mississippi when I was in high school there. And I had no concept that there was another gay person anywhere within 100 miles. That's how deeply closeted I was and how deeply closeted the town was. And now there's gay bars and there's people who are out, but I still have friends who live together who pretend that they have girlfriends. They're my age. They're 50 years old and they're still pretending because they're afraid they'll get fired. So there's still a ways to go down there.
Mark Childress, do you think you're going to settle into Key West or...
I tend to move around a lot, you know. My daddy worked for Ralston Purina and they moved us every 2 years like the military. So after about a couple of years, I get a little itchy, but Key West is amenable, but I'll move on. I know. I'll be somewhere else. I'll have to go.
You've been listening to an interview with Mark Childress, whose latest novel is Georgia Bottoms. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.